America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, Director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
We have been hearing so much lately in the last 2 years, now going on 3 years, about the black experience, about black Americans, about their position in our society, the advance, or what some people believe is the retreat of civil rights. There are those on the progressive left who have made statements like, well, the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president was really not a good thing because it made us all too complacent about the advance of civil rights. That seems a little preposterous to me. The president of the United States is no small feat for any person to achieve. We're going to be talking about classical liberalism and black prosperity. Joining us to do so as we broadcast live from the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference at Concordia University Chicago, Dr. Rachel Ferguson. She's director of the Free Enterprise Center and assistant dean of the College of Business and professor of business ethics at Concordia University Chicago. She's affiliate scholar with the Acton Institute. That's where you may have heard her speak before. And she's co-author of the new book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Promise of America. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you respond to the objection, I'm sure you've heard it, that you and your co-author are both white people, and they would say, well, you're not qualified to speak to the black experience, its history, and especially offer solutions for our public policy?
Well, I am a political philosopher and my co-author is a historian, so it's partially our job, right, to go back and look at these issues. But I also think it's too much of a burden, really. I mean, black Americans only make up 10% of our population, but the importance of black history to American history is extreme, right? It's extremely important. It determined a lot. And so there are many white scholars doing good work and work that black scholars appreciate. For instance, in this book, I refer to many other books, including The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, and others that are by white scholars. And so we are really in a tradition of scholarship that's been happily accepted by the black community.
You say that the problem is not that we're incapable of thinking through the difficult cultural and policy issues, but a phenomenon that you call bundling. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, in a way it's unavoidable, right? Whenever we form party platforms, we have to put a bunch of ideas together and decide where we stand on them in order to move forward politically. But as a philosopher, I don't necessarily have to do that, right? I can unbundle some of those ideas and consider them one at a time. And if you look historically, you'll notice, for instance, that the first wave of feminism was pro-life, right? Or some of the first environmentalists were very conservative, like Teddy Roosevelt, right? And so things went one way or another, sometimes as a result of historical accident. And so there's no reason to necessarily associate certain issues with one another. For instance, if I care about the history of racial injustice in America, why do we assume that I code left, right? But we often do. Or if you are someone who leans right politically, we assume that you don't care. But why in the world would we do that when so many of the things that black Americans have suffered have been violations of our own constitution, right? Of our own liberal values of property rights, freedom of contract, and the equal protection of the rule of law.
Does the black experience fit into the convenient political categories that we're accustomed to handling?
Yeah, it really doesn't. So this surprises people a lot because we know that as a voting bloc, black Americans tend to vote for the Democrats. But in fact, they don't really fit into the majority culture's political split. And so, for instance, black Americans tend to be the most centrist of all Democrats. They tend to actually poll very conservative on social issues, particularly sexuality and gender, and are very pro-market. I mean, I think we saw that when we saw Sanders versus as Biden get to South Carolina, right? As soon as black Americans could decide, it went with Biden. Because there may be a favoritism towards a thicker welfare state, but there is not really any interest in socialism or democratic socialism in the black community. And so that just did not resonate with that community at all.
You say that contrary to the claims of systemic racism, black Americans have actually been excluded from otherwise good political institutions and the American constitutional order. That's really the thesis of your book. It's not that we have systemic racism, it's that we haven't applied our own rules well enough to the black community.
Yeah, and I'm really just repeating the line from Frederick Douglass, right? Frederick Douglass loved the Constitution. He said it was a great liberty document. He said the problem isn't the Constitution, it's whether Americans have honor enough and courage enough to live up to the Constitution. And so what I'm saying is, our polarized extremes that we're taking right now are saying either we care about racial injustice and we've given up on the American project, or we think that the Constitution is so rife with racism that we can't redeem it, or on the other side, we have a kind of fantastical history of the United States where we're not willing to talk about the uglier or darker elements of our history. And what I'm saying is, no, no, no. I mean, actually, we can have a very hopeful account in which we see America as a revolutionary project that is acknowledging the equal rights of human beings, that they ought to be taken into account by their governments, but that we carried in this baggage from the past, right, of the institution of slavery. And it set us up really for failure. And as a matter of fact, many of the founders said this, even Thomas Jefferson, right? He said, it's like we've got the wolf by the ears. Slavery was an institution that, if it was not taken care of, was going to spell the end of the American project because it's so incompatible with a free society. And so we had to address it. And the founders knew that.
Why have progressive solutions and their policies that have come out of those, why have they failed the black community?
Yeah, so my critique of the progressive mindset is really the classical liberal critique, and that is the idea, it's called the information problem. The notion is that in a highly complex society like our own, especially in a highly complex economy, everyone needs to operate based on their own local knowledge. You need that freedom of movement. You need to be able to respond to the what's going on in your own neighborhood and your own economy. And so the progressive mindset goes wrong because it's really focused on central planning, right? Adam Smith called it the man of system mindset. And the idea is that modern life has gotten awfully complicated, and so we're going to have to put experts in charge, and these experts are going to decide how we all need to operate. And so it always fails because the central planner doesn't have the information. The central planner doesn't have the knowledge you and I have about our own lives, right? And what's going on with the prices that we're dealing with and our own budgets and things like that. And so it often creates what's called unintended consequences, right? Where you have one idea of what you want to get out of a policy, but you end up getting the exact opposite. And we see this rife through the 20th century with the black community. For instance, in the Federal Housing Administration's practice of redlining, right? The idea was really a progressive idea. It was the idea that blacks and whites would do better if they were kept separate. But that has been absolutely disastrous for our whole community. And you can say the same for an early progressive idea, actually, which is the minimum wage. And I know this is a little controversial of an opinion, but it was Milton Friedman's view as well. The idea that these early progressive eugenicists actually wanted to exclude some people from employment by keeping the wages so high that only white heads of households would be hired, and they wanted to exclude immigrants and women and black people. And they did that through the minimum wage. And this is not a conspiracy theory. I can show you right in the textbook where they say that's exactly what they're trying to do. And so Milton Friedman went on to say, you know, the minimum wage is actually the most anti-black policy he'd ever come across, because these young black teenagers were not getting jobs. We had taken the bottom rung off of the ladder of economic advancement.
What is classical liberalism? It's kind of, that term has gone in conservative circles from being a pejorative now to being, now wait a minute, we may need to look at what the old liberals were actually saying.
Yeah, so the term liberal is used in a very strange way in America and in Canada. It's not used that way anywhere else in the world. Because, of course, it comes from the Latin term liber, meaning free, right? And so a liberal society is one that is based on the idea that the government's job is to protect the individual freedoms of the citizens. And so my international students are always puzzled when they come to America, because in their countries, the liberal party would be the more free market party, right? And here we call liberals people who lean left. So we've adopted the term classical liberal to go back to that philosophy of the founders, where we're really looking at protecting the individual rights of the citizen. And so I keep it really simple in the book. We talk about three institutions: private property, freedom of contract, and the equal protection of just laws. And then we look at a couple of values. One is that we really think the free market is incredibly effective. So we have a lot of hope in people's creativity and the ability of trade to make us all better off. And then the second one is just thick civil society institutions. Any free society will have to have a lot of voluntary organization. And Americans are very good at this. So the famous Alexis de Tocqueville said, you know, if you go to France or England, it's some lord or it's the government doing it. But if you go to America, they form a club, right? And so we're very good at those thick civil society institutions.
What then is social justice? That's also been a term hijacked for other purposes.
Right. And so it's like the million-dollar question, right? Because what we need to figure out is what people mean when they use the term social justice. And so, you know, we have actually an original meaning coming from a Jesuit named Taparelli, who was really just talking about a good constitutional order, right? So he just sort of meant justice in society. Later, you get a use of the term social justice that was really scary. It was the idea of trying to establish perfect material equality of outcome. And the great Nobel Prize winning economist F.A. Hayek called this a mirage. He says, this is a terrible idea, because if we try to establish perfect equality of outcome, you'll actually require a totalitarian government. So it's a very scary goal. But I think oftentimes our neighbors and friends, or maybe teachers at your kids' schools, they don't often mean that, right? They don't mean anything that extreme. They often mean something like, well, don't we need to stand up for the poor and voiceless, or something like this? And so those who aren't necessarily philosophers, they're not thinking too deeply about the exact language, may just mean something like that. And I think the classical liberal tradition absolutely acknowledges that. So if you go back to Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and many of the early thinkers and our founders, they were often pointing out, including Madison, right? Madison talks about this as well. They were often pointing out that a free society is one in which regular people do better. Not the nobility, not the aristocracy, regular people, regular day laborers are getting better and better lives. They're getting access to medicine. They're able to send their kids to school instead of work. This is good for regular people. And so I think that concern for the poor comes through in classical liberalism as well.
What is the 1619 Project? I think it still is kind of gasping a little bit out of the New York Times. And what are its problems?
Yeah, so the 1619 Project is a New York Times project that was undertaken to try and center Black history in American history. And I think it suffers from the same thing a lot of our ideological sort of pathologies suffer from, which is that they may point out something interesting or something we should pay attention to, but they totalize it. Right? So they take something, yes, of course we should pay attention to Black history. That's a very important part of American history. But the idea is that now we have a lens through which we interpret everything, right? And it colors everything. And so what happened with the 1619 Project is that they ended up sort of coming to the conclusion that our history of racism meant that the whole American project was sort of hopeless. And you do see this kind of despair sometimes on the left. So for instance, Ta-Nehisi Coates says he doesn't even want his children to play with white children. I mean, that's a really dark and despairing vision for our future. And so I think that's where they went wrong. And they also went wrong in just making some plain old mistakes. And so there's been some academic criticism of some of the claims made in the project, and we do deal with that in one of the chapters of the book.
Dr. Rachel Ferguson is our guest. She's co-author of the new book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Promise of America. On the other side of the break, that totalizing of ideas has manifested itself in anti-racism. Why will it fail?
Job saw the city as a wasteland, as if devoid of God, witnessing injustice to the poor by the corrupt, lawlessness of criminals, trafficking of children, blatant immorality, thinking God could not see wicked deeds done in the dark of night. Yet God never abandoned Job, nor his city, groaning for mercy. God is working through the living Redeemer, hands etched with salvation, pointing to the resurrection to come. Join us at lcms.org/citymission to seek peace and shine the light in the city.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we continue our journey through the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, with the fifth trumpet part two, the sixth trumpet, the little scroll, eating the scroll, and two witnesses. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
For 160 years, St. John Lutheran Church Child Care and Preschool has been a congregation committed to bringing Christ's salvation to the people of Fredonia, Wisconsin. We gather to receive the Lord's gifts and His divine service to us each Sunday at 8 and 10:30. If you're in the northern suburbs of Milwaukee and looking for a traditionally liturgical church, please join us this Sunday. For more information regarding education or enrollment, visit us online at stjohnfredonia.org.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You may be one of those pastors who need to be refreshed and refueled because of your parish ministry.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Charles Geeshan.
Concordia Theological Seminary has a wonderful program, not only in continuing education during the summer, but in an advanced study program called the Doctor of Ministry. And it's a very practical program because it focuses on congregational ministry. It incorporates biblical theology with the ministry of the congregation. It's also very accessible for pastors, and it's also affordable. You can major in pastoral care and leadership, teaching and preaching, or mission and culture. And we pray that pastors will take advantage of this program.
Learn more about the Doctorate of Ministry program at ctsfw.edu. or by calling 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, broadcasting from the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference at Concordia University, Chicago. We're talking about classical liberalism and black prosperity with Dr. Rachel Ferguson. She's co-author of the new book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Promise of America. Before the break, you were talking about that totalizing impulse, and that is seen so clearly in anti-racism, the idea of anti-racism, where everything is viewed through the lens of a racist filter, and nothing is spared whatsoever. Why will anti-racism as an idea fail?
Well, we have a couple of critiques of anti-racism in the book. One is that they define racism far too broadly. So if you define racism in such a way that Denzel Washington, Barack Obama, and Zora Neale Hurston are all racists, I think you have a problem, right? And so oftentimes it's defined according to basically social scientific views that they don't want to be associated with. So for instance, if you were to emphasize something like the importance of fatherhood, you might be associated with racism. But of course, Barack Obama was very concerned about black fatherhood. And so is Denzel Washington, right? And so that would be very strange. So I don't think people are really going to resonate with that long term. I also think there's too much emphasis on paying attention to gaps. So one of the things Ibram X. Kendi does is he's always comparing sort of the white-black gap, whether it's wealth or incarceration rates or things like that. And the problem with that is he's assuming that anything that makes the gap bigger is discrimination, and if it's smaller, then that's good. But of course, this may not always be true. So if we see incarceration rates go down in general, and so white rates go down and black rates go down, but for whatever reason, it widens the gap, black people could actually be doing better. They could be having better outcomes, even though the gap is getting bigger. Do you follow what I'm saying? And so it's not actually correct to focus on the gaps. What you want to focus on is just an objective measure of well-being, right? So you want to focus on issues of poverty or mass incarceration, but you don't necessarily want to always be comparing. That'll give you a weird outcome. And then finally, Kendi has some suggestions that are just unconstitutional. So he wants to come up with basically a committee in the government that's going to measure those gaps and then decide what legislation is allowed to go through based on whether he believes that, or the committee decides that it will make the gaps bigger or smaller. And there's absolutely no basis in the Constitution for anything like that. So I think not only could it actually end up getting rid of some good policies, some policies that would be very good for black people, but it's also just, it just oversteps the power of the government.
How should we understand black history? You have a lot of history in this book. How should we understand it in light of those classical liberal values?
Yeah, I think this is key. So what we want to go back and do is show how so many of the things that black Americans have suffered are violations of those basic classical liberal values of property, freedom of contract, and the rule of law. And so we want to be able to talk intelligently and with grace about these episodes, right? In the book, I discuss the practice of convict leasing, which was just awful. And many black men who were innocent were thrown in jail, and many of them died in work camps. It was a terrible crime against black Americans. We can go on and talk about the 20th century. I already mentioned the minimum wage and FHA redlining. I also talk about the way that the federal highway system was built. I talk about the program of urban renewal, which James Baldwin called Negro removal. And what's the point? Those were abuses of eminent domain, right? Those were cases in which massive federal projects were undertaken with a very progressive mindset in order to socially engineer all of our major cities and decide where people were going to live and who they were allowed to trade with, right? If you look at Jim Crow, what a violation of the free market to have a cascade of municipal and state laws telling you who you can trade with and who you can make contracts with and who you can sit down and have lunch with. Those are all violations of really those basic constitutional values. And so we can go back and tell that history using that sort of language.
So in that vein, there was maybe a period post-Civil War when the black family, the black community were able to access, for the first time ever in the United States, were able to access the institutions of America before the New Deal and the Great Society and all those things kind of messed everything up for them. Talk about some examples of black entrepreneurship post-Civil War.
Yeah, so I mean, I want to be clear. During the Reconstruction period, you do have help for freedmen, you know, from a legal perspective. The white supremacy in the South was very real, you know, after Reconstruction failed. And so you do have a period in which it's really an uphill battle, but you still see amazing accomplishments. So for instance, the economist Robert Higgs says that the leap forward in black literacy is something that maybe was the greatest leap you've seen thus far in history. You go from basically zero literacy, and like good Protestants, black Americans want to read their Bibles, right? They want to know how to read so they can read their Bibles. By 1930, 80% of black Americans are literate. That's amazing. That's a huge leap forward. A lot of that's coming out of the black church, which we call the cultural womb of black America. The churches are organizing these schools. Talk about a thick civil society institution. That's a great example. And then, of course, the great Booker T. Washington, who was called the leader of the race. Booker T. Washington coming out of the Hampton Institute, where there was so much emphasis on black property ownership. And Washington really pushed for black people to gain economic power. And we want to emphasize that while W.E.B. Du Bois tried to kind of, we might say, you know, smear Washington with the idea that he was an accommodationist. Of course, Washington was in the Deep South and had to be very careful about how he spoke. But the truth is that Washington knew that you needed economic power in order to make sure that you could get those political rights. And so we see people like Madam C.J. Walker, a millionaire, the first millionaire. She was a black hair care product manufacturer. She's giving the NAACP their first major financial gift. You see the publisher, John H. Johnson, who started Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine, right? He's the one who decides to publish that awful picture of Emmett Till that really wakes America up to some of the terrible things that are happening in the Deep South and is a pivotal moment for the civil rights movement. Others like T.R.M. Howard, who was also a big fan of guns. He had quite an arsenal of guns, and that was very important, actually, for the first civil rights meetings, so that people could make sure that those meetings were not disrupted by outsiders. He was the one who built so many black hospitals, and he went on to protect the family of Emmett Till while they were going to court. And so you have so many important figures that the civil rights movement couldn't have even happened without that middle and upper class of black Americans that Booker T. Washington really built through the National Negro Business League. So we have to see that the search for economic advancement and for political rights go together. They're not opposed.
You say that we should see, you mentioned Emmett Till, we should see these incidents of atrocities against black people and communities as, what do you call it, focused lawlessness. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think just recently more of us have become aware of the massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921, but this is actually only one of several major massacres that occur. And what we have to admit here is that the entire white community, including the police and even the National Guard sometimes delaying, really participated in the destruction of their neighbors' towns. And they did this in a way that I truly believe was motivated by envy. And so in the book, we take a moment to pause and remind everyone that envy is a vice that is really incompatible with a commercial society. Because in a commercial society, I have to believe that when you do well, it benefits me, right? You're creating a product and now it's cheaper for me, or I have something that's higher quality. And that was true in Greenwood, which was the part of Tulsa where the black folks lived. They were all working for one another and trading with one another. The white community should have been able to see that as a positive thing. But because envy is a status good, I have to be above you and I have to destroy what you have. They just in a few days killed hundreds of their neighbors and destroyed that town completely. And so you have to admit these episodes of focused lawlessness in which even those who were responsible for defending the rights of all citizens actually participated in much of that sort of domestic terror against their neighbors.
You mentioned the black church. What role has it had in the advancement of black America?
Absolutely central. Absolutely central. This cannot be overstated. In chapter 5 of the book, I actually go through and look at the history of the black church and how it was a real blessing, actually, to get to do that research. It blessed my soul to learn that history. And what I realized is that the black church is the one area of privacy. It's the one area where black leadership comes to play, right? It's the one area where what's being done there is up to black people and not really up to outsiders. And so what the black church does is it actually carries much more maybe than what you and I might consider church to have to do, right? In other words, it's both the place where you worship, but it's also the place where you have your art shows. It's also the place where you learn to read. It's also the place where you network for your business. It's also, right, it ends up serving all of those purposes and really being like the community center for black America. And to this day, by the way, black Americans are the most religious demographic in the United States, more likely than any other demographic to pray, to read the Bible, believe in God. Even black millennials are more religious than white millennials.
What does black conservatism look like?
Well, it kind of depends on whether that question is normative or descriptive, right? And so what I would say is that, many of the black conservatives that we discuss in the book actually lean heavily classical liberal. So if you think of Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams, these guys were economists, right? So they were students of Milton Friedman, very free market oriented. The current writer for the Wall Street Journal, Jason Riley, is a good example. He's very classical liberal. He wrote the book with the hilarious title, Please Stop Helping Us. I just reviewed his book, Black Boom, which was very good. And so you actually do have a strong contingency of classical liberals among black conservatives, which I think is significant. But I also want to say that you have this really interesting group called the Black Conscious Conservatives, and I just want to mention them. They're small but mighty. They're very interesting, very GOP, very red, Republican leaning. But the Black Conscious Conservatives kind of challenge other black conservatives by saying, when you want to eschew discussion of the past, you actually give up your chance to demonstrate how destructive progressive policies can actually be. And so they're saying, don't do that, right? Don't say that we just need to forget the past and move on. Let's talk about the past because it actually shows how progressivism fails and how what we need are strong families and strong markets.
You talk about something that you call transitional justice. What is it?
Yeah, transitional justice actually comes from the international community. It's a type of justice that deals with sort of society-wide injustices like apartheid-like systems. And what transitional justice says is that we need to deal with these injustices in a society-wide way, but we need to do it at a very local level, and we need to keep it very concrete. So when we're looking at the history, do things in your own town, right? Look back at your own history of your own town. What's going on there? And how can we honor those who survived and those maybe even who didn't survive, right? And so that that town is healing itself, right? So that there's reconciliation within that town. And I think you can contrast transitional justice with social justice as it's often used, which is very sort of vague, hard to wrap your head around. When will we be done, right? When will we have accomplished this? In the case of transitional justice, it's very concrete. And I think if conservatives and libertarians and classical liberals would remain in the conversation of doing some of that institutional memory, it would keep it more grounded in reality and in the concrete of what happened, as opposed to being about, you know, just very hard to define ideas about oppression that may or may not be real.
Dr. Rachel Ferguson is our guest. We're talking about classical liberalism and black prosperity. On the other side of the break, we'll discuss black fraternal societies. She's co-author of the new book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Promise of America.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. LutherAcademy.com and like them on Facebook. Facebook.com/LutherAcademy.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkie. We're broadcasting from the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference at Concordia University Chicago. We're talking about classical liberalism and black prosperity with Dr. Rachel Ferguson, director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia University Chicago. You had mentioned the church, but there are also black fraternal societies that we need to know about to understand the black experience.
Yeah, this is a really incredible story. You know, in the early 20th century, the majority of black men were all involved in these mutual aid societies or fraternal societies. They were actually a form of insurance, although they didn't pool according to risk. You just paid your dues. You know, you just were involved. But if you got sick at work, they could cover you. If you died, they could help your widow with your funeral costs. It was really a wonderful thing. But like all civil society institutions, that may have been its primary goal, but it had a lot of secondary effects, right? And so, of course, if you're in the Black Elks, say, then you're also, you know, meeting possible business partners and people who might give you a no-interest loan and those sorts of things. And so it reminds us that when the government takes over, you know, a certain sort of service, it crowds out civil society. And so if participation in fraternal societies starts to fade as the government sort of takes over social services, what you also lose are those secondary effects, right? And that's sort of what's not seen, is you lose that kind of networking and that community support that you would have had in the early 20th century. So that's a sad loss. I think black men are still overrepresented in participation in fraternal societies today, but not nearly at the level they were at the early part of the 20th century.
This is a big question, but what policy forces were at work undermining black progress in the 20th century?
Yeah, so I've mentioned a few, right? This massive social engineering that's undertaken by the progressives, and with that sort of mindset. Of course, we can talk about the Great Society as well, and we try to tell a pretty nuanced story here. We certainly agree with conservatives. I think it's very undeniable that the perverse incentives of the welfare state have really undermined, for instance, the black family, black social structure. But we want to add some nuance to that. We want to say, for instance, that actually, there's a pretty sad story to tell about the role of unions here. Unions were very, very racist in the history of America, with the idea, kind of that zero-sum game notion of the economy, right? If I win, I need you to lose. So I need to keep you out in order for me to keep my wages up. And so that's what a lot of white unionists did. And what that meant is that they pushed wages up so high that manufacturing jobs were lost a lot sooner than they would have been. They would have been eventually, right? We were going to automate or offshore eventually, but they were lost sooner because wages were pushed up so high. And so a lot of black men who were excluded from the unions anyway actually missed that step, right, in economic development from pure manual labor to manufacturing and then on to something else. They never got that manufacturing step. We think that also had a part to play in the undermining of the family structure. And then, of course, the contraception shock, which just changed the sexual politics between men and women and the way that we dealt with marriage and childbearing. And so what we want to say is that, for instance, if we're talking about family structure, that affected the black family first because that was the families that were the most vulnerable economically. But we now see that that's affecting all of our families. And so we see that in the Latino community, out of wedlock birth is at 50%, and in the white community, 30%. And of course, in poor government dependent white communities out in rural areas, the numbers are very, very high. We see a lot of the same problems there, of course, that we see in our poor inner cities. And so this isn't something specific to black Americans. It's just something that they suffered through first.
You talked about the family, but that at the next level we have the black neighborhood. How has the disintegration of the black neighborhood affected the lives of black people? And can we reverse that? Well, in some places, I live in on the east side across from St. Louis. East St. Louis, once a very prosperous town, was considered the right side of the river back in the day, is now someplace you do not want to go under any circumstances.
Yeah, that's right. And so as we tell that story about redlining plus the highways plus the urban renewal, which was a lot of eminent domain abuse, what we see, and the highways is a particularly obvious one, because what we see is municipal leaders getting millions of dollars from the federal government and then deciding, where should I place this road, right? And they place this road just right in the black and Latino economic centers of every major American city. They want to divide the white population from other populations, but they also want to get rid of what they consider to be slums. But of course, we know that many, and we can look back at the data, Florida and see this, that many of these areas were working class but upwardly mobile areas, and it was a very important step. It was also a very important communal center, right? Churches, schools, those fraternal societies, the Black Elks Lodges, right? Many of those were just destroyed in the building of the highway system. And so what we see there are people sort of being thrown to the four winds, and it's not easy to reconstitute your community association somewhere else. And so this is just a terrible, terrible blow to Black neighborhoods. We now have, as we know, in many of our inner cities, a kind of ghettoized, and I'm using that term in the denotative sense, right? Actually isolated and separated out communities. And so these people are suffering from what I call network poverty, highly isolated, away from the employment networks and even away from examples of family structure that could help people to transition back into a healthier dynamic. And so what I talk about in the book, and this is so important, especially with a Christian audience, is the neighborhood stabilization movement. Because no matter whether we get every policy we wish we could get into place, there are going to be some neighbors that will not have the bandwidth to take advantage of those good policies because things have just become undermined to that extent. And so when we look at people like Bob Lupton and his book Toxic Charity, or Brian Fickert and his book When Helping Hurts, John Perkins or the great Bob Woodson and the Woodson Center, what we're seeing here are people who are giving us a new philanthropic paradigm. And they're saying to us, you need to focus in on one block at a time with 8 to 10 years of commitment, deep personal presence, and real love in order to walk through life with people to repair what's been lost. Now, each one of us is not necessarily called to be the person who moves to the neighborhood. Some people will be, but the rest of us are those networks. We have those networks, right? And so my friend Lucas at Love the Lou, which is on Enright Boulevard in St. Louis, in North St. Louis, he has us come in and we mentor students, we mentor parents, we help inner city entrepreneurs figure out taxes and QuickBooks and things like that. We do the sorts of things that you and I probably take for granted. We have our friends and our networks that we can call when we have those questions, but many people in the inner city do not. So we're offering those kinds of networks along with the healing that we want to bring to those families.
You had mentioned the incarceration crisis, and that is something that is, if you look at the numbers, it's just shocking. It's stunning. Describe it to us, and then what is its cause, and is there a solution?
Yeah, this is a very complicated problem. So just to give you the very short version, I'll say it's absolutely true that in the 1970s, crime started going up in an almost stunning way, and it continued to go up until the mid-90s. So there was a reason that more and more people were incarcerated. There was 20 years of crime going up and up and up. But what happened is during that time, certain sort of, you know how bureaucracies can sometimes take on their own logic, right? And then they can start operating on their own and in a way that is disconnected from their purpose. And so that's really what happened with prosecutors' offices. So after crime began to plummet in the mid-90s, what you actually see, and I put the graph in the book because it's so stark, what you actually see is incarceration just continuing to go up. So it's not connected to the crime that's actually happening or to our need for safety or just retribution. And so what we see is, you know, really a prosecutor's office that's very, very unaccountable. We don't really know what's going on there. And 98% of cases are handled through plea bargains. You know, our constitutional right to a trial is not hardly ever being used. And in a way, people are being punished if they do want to use it. Because if they know that they're innocent and they say, I want to say I'm innocent and I want to go to trial, that prosecutor will say, well, with all these mandatory minimums and stacked charges and things, I can hold an 80-year sentence over your head. So you might as well just say you're guilty and I'll give you 10. That's actually happening a lot, which means that we have a lot of innocent people in prison. And we also know that it's ineffective. Most criminals, no offense to the young people here, but most criminals are 18 to 24-year-old males, okay? What we know about their frontal lobes, right? They're not long-term thinkers, okay? So what that means is holding really long-term prison sentences over people's heads is actually very ineffective. The effective thing to do is to have very high clearance rates so that police are closing the case very quickly and the punishment is coming through very quickly. That's what's going to really motivate criminals to do something different, but I think we're often keeping police busy doing a lot of other things than the detective work that they were really hired to do.
So let's talk concrete policies that, if you had to pick your top three concrete policies that could undo much of the damage that has been done over the last 200 years. And actually, maybe because the law teaches, educate the American people a little bit about the real problem here and the real solutions.
Yeah, so I'm glad you picked three, because we've got three policies that we actually
I read the book.
Pay a lot of attention to, yeah. So one of them is criminal justice reform, and this is an interesting one for sort of being kind of anti-tribal, which is part of what we try to do in this book, because we talk about another book called Prison Break, and the subtitle is How Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. It's a really interesting book about the way that Prison Fellowship and Chuck Colson and that crowd got together with Pew Research and figured out how crazy out of control these numbers are, how out of control state budgets are, and they started to think of creative ways to address criminal justice reform. Some of our most and best attempts at criminal justice reform have happened in Texas and Oklahoma and Georgia and Kansas. It's actually very surprising. It might not code the way you'd expect, right? So criminal justice reform is an important one, and we can talk about what's appropriate there. We also talk about what I consider to be one of the greatest justice issues of our time, and that is educational freedom. If everything I just said about highways and urban renewal and FHA redlining is true, then we're only extending and perpetuating that injustice when we trap students in failing schools. And so we really think that we need to bring the entrepreneurial spirit of the market into education so that kids who are dealing with tons of complicated obstacles can have people bring their creativity and their freedom into that space in order to give kids really interesting solutions. And so we don't think that the education system needs to fail students, but in order to not fail them, we need that funding to follow the student and not be determined by the zip code. And then finally, we talk about economic freedom and economic growth. And this is one that I think confuses people too, because they assume if you care about economic growth, you care about rich people and corporations, right? That's who cares about economic growth. Absolutely not. The people who are most affected, especially in terms of their marginal utility, right? The real meaning to their lives. People who are most affected by recessions are the poor, right? They're the ones who lose their jobs. They're the ones whose homes are foreclosed on. That can change your whole trajectory of your life if there's fewer scholarships available. And those who are most affected in a positive way by economic growth are also the poor. And so it's really important that we have just common sense policies like the corporate tax rate going down that we saw in 2017. That was brilliant, right? Because it kept the jobs here and it kept corporations here. And so we want those sorts of things for the poor. And we see that in the data. The data actually shows, and this is part of Jason Riley's book, Black Boom, that Black Americans did very well between 2017 and 2019. And it's because of a lot of that real boring stuff, right? Keep taxes low, deregulate, et cetera. And so we can also look at specific cases of economic freedom, things like occupational licensing reform. Why should a barber need a high school degree? You don't need one to be a good barber. Why does an African hair braider need to go to cosmetology school? She doesn't, right? But why do these things happen? Because of cronyism. Established businesses set up regulations to keep out startups, right? To keep out their competition. And so we really have to bang our fists about cronyism and make sure that we don't let established businesses shut out poor entrepreneurs who are trying to pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Dr. Rachel Ferguson is director of the Free Enterprise Center and assistant dean of the College of Business and professor of business ethics at Concordia University, Chicago. She's affiliate scholar with the Acton Institute and co-author of the new book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Promise of America. She will be signing this book at the Concordia Publishing House booth right after the broadcast. I think we should also run her for president. That would be a good idea. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Next week on Issues Etc., we'll get a biography of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas from Mark Paoletta. We'll discuss the Quran with Robert Spencer. We'll continue our series responding to Roman Catholic proof texts with Dr. Stephen Parks. And we'll talk with pastors Will Wheaton and Sean Denzer about the Lord's Prayer in the Divine Service. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening and good night from Concordia University, Chicago.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.